You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Ashley Dyer.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you. Before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about some sponsors today. Crystal Pico Watanabe at Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. She's got a team of 8 people who help provide services to fiction authors. And she has a full slate of services that now include beta reading. She's got 4 beta readers now. So if you're looking for beta reading services, she can definitely take on your project. Manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors can also inquire about putting their books in her Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. It's free to authors for a limited time. Be sure to check out Crystal and her whole team at Pico's House. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com. Thanks, Crystal, for sponsoring the show. While Cape and Spandex movies are breaking box office records, comic book commentator and influencer Ed Gosney doesn't want us to forget the roots of these marvelous wonders. His blog, Cool Comics in My Collection, at edgosney.com, covers the gamut of four-color entertainment, from contemporary comic books to comics made for kids to bargain bin gold to classics that will transport you back in time. Comic books are a perfect blend of art and story, and Cool Comics captures the essence of what these funny books mean to us in a personal way. And make sure to join the Cool Comics in My Collection Facebook group, where members can interact, show off their prized comics, and have opportunities to win, you guessed it, Cool Comics. Published weekly, Cool Comics in My Collection aims to bring you a smile and reminds us why comic books are fun. Be sure to visit edgosney.com today. Speaking of superheroes and comics, my friend Patricia Gillum has a fantastic series called The Heroes of Corvus. It begins with book 1, a flight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of 3 innocent civilians and orphaning a 6-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the deaths of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city aren't out of danger. This is such a phenomenal story. She has released up to part 4 now, and I cannot wait for part 5 to come out. If you're looking for a great adventure read that's on the cutting edge of what is in today's entertainment, The Heroes of Corvus is the series for you by Patricia Gillum. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com to subscribe to the show. We're on just about every platform you can imagine. Now stay tuned for our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Ashley Dyer on the show. If you guys remember from last year, Ashley is actually 2 people, Margaret Murphy and Helen Pepper, and they write under the pseudonym Ashley Dyer. They have a phenomenal new book out. It's called The Cutting Room, and if you guys remember last year's book, Splinter in the Blood, this book takes that these characters and takes the premise from last time and ramps it up to an almost nerve shattering level, and I love it so much. Welcome to the show, Margaret and Helen. How are you today?
Absolutely great, thanks. I'm so much better having heard that introduction. What an introduction! Thank you.
Yes, it was brilliant, wasn't it?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Margaret, that was you first, and Helen, that was you second?
Yeah, that's right. I'm Margaret.
And I'm Helen.
Excellent. Just give our listeners a reference point for who is who. Margaret, this is book number what for you as a writer?
Oh, Lord. I think it must be 14 or 15.
Gotcha. Yeah. And you write a series of psychological thrillers on your own, and then started this series with Helen last year. How has this been? How has this journey been for you, co-writing with someone? And has it affected your solo writing, having had this experience with Helen?
Oh, that's a really good question. The journey has been fantastic because it's been so well received, really internationally.
Yeah.
And working with someone else is so different. You know, as you'll appreciate as a novelist yourself, it's so different than working completely on your own. So you've got someone that you can always check things with, and you know, even down to the very basic stuff of doing events together. So it's a joint experience. It's much more fun that way. In terms of my solo writing, I haven't done an awful lot of it actually over the last year, because we've been really focusing, because there was such a good response to Splinter in the Blood, we have been focusing on continuing the Ashley Dyer series and working on those aspects.
Helen, you're not a traditional fiction writer. Let's just put it that way. You have done lots of writing, and you are very well respected in your area of expertise, and that's in crime scene analysis. You're a forensic scientist, a crime scene investigator, all of this stuff. How has this affected you now that you had the novel out? You went through that experience. We talked about it last time, of the writing the book. Well, now the book is out there, and then you guys have repeated that process. How has fiction affected your life?
Well, it's been absolutely brilliant for me. I mean, I've been sort of working with writers for about 20 years. So I've got quite a lot of experience of advising people and telling people how it will be. But the process of actually being involved with the book from the very genesis of an idea all the way through. And I don't claim to be any sort of a writer. I'm not a writer. Margaret does the writing. But actually being involved in the whole process, the highs and the lows, it's absolutely brilliant. I've loved it.
Helen, do you ever look at Margaret and say, you know, it's my job to stop this kind of stuff from happening, and here you are dreaming this stuff up? does it ever kind of hit you funny that, here we are making up these stories about the things that I've given my life to solving and all of that sort of stuff?
No, not so much. I sometimes worry about the weird things that go on in her head. That does bother me, you know, because she can come up with some really strange things. You just wouldn't know it to look at her.
That's so funny. You know, I've talked to a lot of mystery writers, thriller writers, horror writers, and they're always the sweetest, kindest people. And you just have to wonder, you know, are we telling these kinds of stories to keep the monsters at bay? What do you think it is about these kinds of stories that so many of us love? And you know, one of the premises of the new book is the kind of wave of true crime series and things that are sweeping the UK. Well, also in the US, that's one of the biggest things. We just can't get enough of it. What do you think it is about our fascination with these kinds of stories?
Well, for me, I always say it's like being on a roller coaster. It's like feeling that you're in a huge amount of danger, but really knowing that you're safe and it's not going to come and get you. And I think the liking for crime fiction is exactly the same as the liking for true crime, because true crime series and true crime books that are successful are the ones where the crime is detected. Not very much happens in popular true crime where the crime isn't detected. So I think we've still got that overlap to wanting to feel the thrill of danger, but wanting to feel safe at the same time. It's resolved. The bad person's been caught.
Right. Margaret, how has how has it been working with Helen and having that close confidant or the close source of such such a wealth of knowledge in this area? How has that helped your fiction writing?
In various ways, actually. From the point of view of information, I do a lot of background reading, I do a lot of research, and I really enjoy it. Some authors don't, I really enjoy it. But the fact of the matter is that forensic crime and forensic crime detection is changing all the time. I know there's a very popular series called The Forensic Files in the US. It's come over here as well because we have it on Netflix, and my husband's an addict. So a lot of these cases are picked up 10 or 15 years later, and changes and developments in forensic science mean that investigations that had stalled, completely stalled and gone cold, are able to be picked up and the perpetrator is caught. Now, I can do reading around that subject, but Helen is going to always be several steps ahead of me on that. And there have been occasions where, you know, I've said to her, well, I know it sounds a bit weird and probably not possible, but would it be possible for this to happen? And Helen will say, oh, yeah, I'm sure I read about something recently. I'm just going to go and check. And she'll come back sort of half a day later and say, yes, there's an article on this. I knew I'd read it somewhere. But on the other hand, she also acts to rein me in on occasions, because sometimes I can let myself get carried away with research. So one example actually in this book, and I'm not giving any spoilers away at all, but there is fingerprint is caught in what we call perspex. I think you call it plexiglass.
Okay, right.
It is trapped in a plexiglass block, and we think that might give us a clue to who the killer is. And I said to Helen, right, so I read this really great article in one of the academic journals, and it says you can actually produce a 3D image using laser lights if you fire them at perspex blocks and create a 3D image of the fingerprint. Should we do that in the book? And I'm going to let Helen pick up the story from there, if that's okay.
Sure.
Well, and I said to her, well, yeah, sure, you can do that. Or you could point the camera down through the block, shine a torch through the side of the block. The torch will cast a shadow and show the fingerprint up, and you can just take its photograph.
Which kind of deflated me somewhat, I must be honest.
Because it's not like on TV. Wherever possible, the CSIs and the forensic people are going to do things that work, but we don't have the budget to spend lots of money on it. So if you can do it with a camera and a torch, why would you go out and buy a laser?
Well, that was going to be a question that I planned to ask you guys, because your detectives, Ruth Lake and Greg Carver, who we were introduced to in Splinter in the Blood, return in this book to some interesting situations. We'll talk about Ruth and Greg in just a minute, what's going on with them. But one thing that I love is that like you said, Helen, kind of that path of least resistance, getting to a common sense answer as easily and as without as much fuss and muss as possible. As an actual investigator, how much does technology help, and how much kind of gets in your way? And I think that's a great example of, we could do this with a laser and we could do all this, but there's really a very common sense answer that's just right there. It's not as sexy, but it works. It gets the job done.
Yeah, so wherever possible, you're going to use the easy, straightforward, and dare I say it, cheap way, but not necessarily because it's cheaper, but because whatever evidence you find and however you find it, at the end of the case, you're going to have to explain that to a jury. And the jury's not necessarily all going to have degrees in molecular biology or, you know, organic chemistry or whatever. So if you can do it in a way that's really simple to explain, so the jury can go, yeah, I get that, I understand that, I know where you're coming from, then it's much better evidence. Sometimes you can't get around it. Sometimes you need lots of expensive kit. But if you can do it easily, that's much, much better.
That's something I never think of, is as you're investigating, keeping in mind that this is a story that you're going to have to tell to a group of people and hopefully be able to communicate what this story means.
Yeah, that's part of the role of the expert witness when they go to court, which in technical terms, we call it educating the jury. They have to understand what you've done and what it means, because otherwise, how can they weigh it up, whether or not it's good evidence?
Right, right. When you're coming up with a new novel and finding a situation to hit the reader over the head with, and then to bring in Lake and Carver, how do you start looking for that great piece of crime, this great happening that you can then start building a story around?
Well, for this particular novel, it was really strange because if I can reveal something here. I had been convinced that Splinter in the Blood would be my last novel. I had no notion that it would create the kind of excitement it did and that it would be taken up worldwide. So I usually start thinking about the next novel about two-thirds the way through writing the one that I'm on. And I hadn't thought about the next novel for obvious reasons. And then our agent, Felicity Blunt, got in touch with us and said, there's a lot of excitement around this at the London Book Fair. And this was before the fair itself. But we've got a few scouts saying, well, what's the next book? Can you provide me with a page, just a page, just to give an idea of what the next book is about? And I said, okay, when do you need this by? Trying not to sound like I was panicked. And she said, well, you know, by the weekend. And this was on Thursday, so she needed it really by the end of Friday.
Oh, no.
And Helen and I had a few kind of, shall we say, excitable phone calls. And I said, look, I'm just going to go away and just think for a bit. And what I thought about was this whole idea that was the setup for Splinter in the Blood was based around something that I found particularly disturbing. And that was an exhibition of skin that I'd seen at a place called the Wellcome Trust in London, probably about 4 or 5 years earlier. Now, following on from that, I thought, well, okay, all you need to do is find something else that freaks you out. And that presumably freaks other people out. And the thing that, when I started thinking about Carver and his situation,
right. It
kind of, that gave me the way in, because Carver, at the very beginning of Splinter in the Blood, suffers quite a serious head injury.
Yes.
And following on from that, he has weird auras and hallucinations. Now, I think I mentioned in our last interview that I have lupus. One of those things I had as a result of lupus was a couple of cerebral incidents. So for a time, you know, I was quite familiar with MRI scans of my brain, and I found them quite kind of compelling and wonderful to look at, but at the same time, really disturbing. I thought, wonder what it would be like if someone were to create art using I thought slices of brain, because I do have a rather dark turn of mind. When I started doing the research behind this, I realized that it's already been done. There's a kind of genre of painting and of art, I should say, that is called bioart, which incorporates aspects of nature and the human body, animal bodies, plants, even bacteria, into art. And one of these was called MRI Butterfly, and it's by it's by an artist called Suzanne Anker, and she uses brain scans, and she superimposed rather beautiful images of butterflies onto those brain scans. And I thought, whoa, this is really, that really made me excited, because I thought I could really use this. And that's where the whole idea originated from.
Margaret, I had no idea that you're in your mind, Splinter in the Blood would be your last novel. There's a really interesting relationship that happens between co-writers, especially when you're writing as one person, and there's kind of a melding of the minds, but a melding of the fortunes too. And you know, when you're kind of linked to one another like that, when you started realizing that there was a lot of demand for Ashley Dyer and for the stories that you were telling, how difficult was that decision to decide to keep going?
Oh, do you know, I would never have dreamt anyone would ask me that question, because you think, well, hey, it's happened at last. But actually, I did find it quite difficult, because, you know, you come to a kind of realization and you come to an acceptance. And then I had to kind of unravel that acceptance and create a new enthusiasm for something that I had never anticipated. So really good question. And yes, it did take me several months to get over that kind of this feeling that, okay, but I thought that was going to be it. And now I have to completely rethink that situation. And I don't think I've even told Helen this. I don't think I have told you that, have I, Helen?
You've sort of hinted, but I'm really glad that you had a rethink.
Aren't we all? Aren't we all? Oh, man. Yeah, that's, you know, life is such a weird thing. You think you've got things figured out. You think that the map is plainly laid before you, and then detours happen. And thank God for life.
Yeah. And it is actually about taking those situations, and it's the way that you approach them, isn't it? It's how you take those, and you kind of, there are setbacks. And Helen was talking about roller coasters before, and we have been on a roller coaster ride in several instances. But it's how you take the setbacks and work through those, but also how you take the opportunities, I think, and you've just got to be flexible, I think.
Sure. The new book, The Cutting Room, which is out of everywhere, available now. I think we forgot to mention that when you're hearing this, while you're listening, you can just hop over to Amazon and grab your copy while you listen to this fantastic conversation. But we find our two main protagonists, Ruth Lake and Greg Carver, and we mentioned them a minute ago. And Greg has this very interesting thing that's going on with him from the head injury that we talked about a minute ago. And I understand, Margaret, that about the, and we did have that conversation earlier about the lupus and the things that come along with that, some of the side effects, if you want to look at it that way. When dealing with Greg's things that are happening with him, and he's maybe getting information. Maybe it feels like he's tuned in to information the rest of us don't have. I can understand the draw from the purely fictional standpoint of, oh, this is a great character trait to get to play with, and you know, it really adds a new element to the story. Helen, as you have worked in the field that you have you ever encountered someone like that who brings things to the investigation, or maybe into the scene at large, that's that things are happening with him or her that you can't quite put your scientist hands on?
I did have one member of staff who was just almost supernatural in his ability to notice things in a scene that other people hadn't noticed. For example, I once dealt with a murder, and we'd found the torso, and it was tied up in a bedsheet. And we'd gone to the murderer's house, and about six of us had examined that house and been in every room. And I just sent this guy in as a final sweep. And within about 30 seconds, he said, oh, look, there's the matching sheet. And it was in a pile of laundry, and no one else had seen it at all. And it was just sort of like he just homed in on it, you know, don't know how he did it, but he was just really spooky, the way that he spotted things that no one else had noticed.
What do you, Margaret, when, what is the, what's the fun of playing with these abilities and the, what they bring to the investigation and to the storytelling?
Well, I guess, Carver, when he, as I kind of imagined him, before his head injury, was a little bit, closed off and unwilling to engage, not very communicative. He is now in a situation where, like it or not, he sees things. He sees, it's a form of synesthesia or synesthesia in which normally people would associate colors with a word. So Wednesday, suddenly they see yellow, or a number might be green. But in this situation, what he's seeing, he's actually reading people's body language and seeing that as colors and auras around them. So anger is represented by an orange aura. And he can even penetrate Ruth's armor plating, and she's very good at hiding her feelings. So this form of synesthesia makes him exposed in a way that he doesn't want to be and never wanted to be as a man and as an investigator. So it introduces a vulnerability, which is fun for me to play with, and also allows Ruth, who has always been quite good at reading people and sort of analyzing rather than just kind of feeling this whole idea of emotion and responses from people. So in a sense, you've got that, a swap over from the cliche, which is that women are intuitive and men, men kind of read people. So she's the one who's analytical and looks at the facts and the data and analyzes it. And he's the one who just responds sometimes very viscerally to body language that he's not aware of on a conscious level, but to these auras that he sees around people. So that's a fun thing to do. You know, it allows you to play with character.
There's a lot of things that you touch on in the book and things that you turn to plot points. The true crime craze, when I first saw the book was going to use that as part of the setup, I really laughed that you guys were kind of taking that head on. And in the book, Britain is obsessed with this true crime television show. And then kind of because of that and because of the heightened awareness of that, Lake and Carver get brought in to this serial killer that's doing these crazy things. And so we've got the true crime obsession. We've got technology because they are being lured in new and inventive ways. What were some of the things when you started kind of putting together what the plot was going to be and things that you were going to springboard off of? How do you start kind of creating a list of, okay, we're going to play on people's love of true crime. We're going to, you know, bring a technological element in and that sort of thing.
I think it wasn't a conscious decision. I didn't create a list in any form. But I've always been fascinated by this idea of social media. And I don't know, I can't remember if I mentioned that I did do a year of a psychology degree at one time, because I was just fascinated with the way in which people would conform to certain things which were obviously wrong and, you know, would ignore awful things that were happening, even though, you know, they could just take action and stop this from happening. So the bystander effect. This idea that people will stand by and watch someone being attacked because they don't kind of take responsibility. They think because other people are watching, someone else will have dealt with that. Someone else will have called the police. So those sorts of things happening. But just having been part of social media, which I did resist for a long time, actually being part of the whole Twitterverse and developing my own kind of Facebook page and so on. I realized just how nasty things could get. And I just wanted to look at that. Yeah, I mean, it's people being trolled, people being, you know, accused of awful things, and threatened, even having, you know, their physical presence threatened, never mind their psychological kind of persona threatened on these in the situation of social media. It's just a fascinating idea to me. And having kind of done some psychology and, you know, looked at things like Stanley Milgram's experiments in the 1960s, where people were persuaded to what they thought was to administer real electric shocks to people who were trying to remember certain facts, and they were told the person that they were delivering the shock to was behind the screen. But they were told, well, you have to administer a shock if they get the question wrong. And they were persuaded to give larger and larger and larger shocks. And they could hear these people screaming as the shocks were being administered. And yet they continued doing it to the point where the people would have died if a real shock had been administered. And this is something, you know, that you think to yourself, oh, I would never do that. And yet a large proportion of people did. And similarly, that there was an experiment at Stanford, I'm sure you're aware of it, the Zimbardo's experiment with the prison guards, where students were supposed to take part in this experiment in which half of them were designated as guards and half of them were designated as prisoners. And they would do a 14-day experiment and look at the social interactions that happened. Well, it got so ugly that after 6 days, they had to end the experiment. And you think, these are just ordinary people. They'd actually, they'd scanned and kind of filtered through to make sure that there were no, they sort of did psychological profiles on them to make sure there were no narcissists, no psychopaths in there, no people who were kind of obsessed with sadism. And yet this awful thing happened and they had to stop the experiment.
That's horrible to think that we all sort of teeter on that edge, and that we could be provoked and almost come to a Pavlovian place where it just gets more, the stimulus becomes more and more addictive. Helen, when you are throughout your career, have you ever been just taken aback and floored by things that you've seen and stories that you've heard, and realizing that in some cases these are not just pure psychopaths, but these are people that have just been stretched and stretched and until they get to that point?
Yes, indeed. I mean, it starts off with the really banal things. I mean, have you ever been in a tailback at a road accident that's purely caused by people stopping for a look as they drive past? You know, that's the start of it, isn't it? But then, yes, you know, if you put people under pressure and a bit more pressure and a bit more. I dealt with a chap who'd murdered his wife, and basically they'd bought a house as a fixer-upper, and he was going to work every day and then working on the house at night. And he wasn't going fast enough for her. It wasn't getting done as quickly as she thought it would. And they were finding all sorts of problems that they didn't know were there with the house. And the pressure just built and built and built to the point where he just snapped. And, you know, just from fixing up a house. So I think it's probably in a lot of people, you just need the right sort of pressure at the right time, or the wrong sort of pressure, depending on how you look at it.
True. There's a talking about the true crime obsession that's going on in the UK and in the US right now. We're seeing some interesting things that are happening. I think it's kind of timely to talk about this for just a minute. There are a lot of documentaries that are going on right now and kind of revisiting some cases and peeling back things. And one has gotten a lot of attention in just the last couple of weeks about the Central Park Five here in America and the investigation and things that went on a couple of decades ago. And you know, a fellow crime writer has gotten a lot of flack and has lost her publisher and all of this because she was a prosecutor back then. What do you think? And I'm not asking you to weigh in on that case, but the way this is, these things are sort of playing out in the media, and we are, and while law enforcement absolutely should be held to a higher standard, are we, is our obsession with these things, weakening, the police's ability to do their job properly, or do you think that that sort of scrutiny is deserved and it needs to be, Helena, as someone who's worked there, and Margaret, who has written a lot of books along these lines, what do you guys think about our obsession with true crime is maybe doing to the actual business of solving crime?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you've heard of the CSI effect, where juries are unwilling to convict unless there's some forensic evidence, because there's always forensic evidence. Well, in actual fact, quite often there isn't. But yes, very much, police and everyone within the criminal justice system should be held to a very, very high account. And they should behave ethically. I mean, I'm not aware of the case that you're actually talking about, but trial by media is never a good way to go, and there have been cases in the UK that have actually fallen over because the media has got involved and put too much in the public domain, to the extent where there couldn't be a fair trial, so the trials had to be abandoned. So I think yes, there's definitely a role for investigative journalism and finding things out, but then it needs to be handed over to be investigated properly.
Right. What about you, Margaret? How do you feel about, I mean, as a crime writer, who is someone who is, telling these kinds of stories that get us excited and let us ride the roller coaster. Do you feel like that bleeds over into real life too much sometimes?
I think it probably does. And I was just reading a few things earlier today about BTK, the bind, torture, kill, serial killer, Dennis Rader. And, you know, this a few people had actually based stories, fictional stories, around him before he was actually caught, because there was a 10-year gap where he went into a kind of hiatus and then became active again. And you do wonder whether those stories, those fictional stories, would have biased a jury, and whether that argument could have been made at the time. But I think the other aspect to it is that because people feel that they can comment and give opinion so easily and really without thinking, without those kind of ethical checks, I suppose, on social media, you wonder how much these things are skewed against a good prosecution. And also, you know, people will judge an individual, a writer, a musician, an artist, whoever, by what kind of person they are rather than on the art itself. I do wonder about the kind of encroachment of, you know, oh yes, we can only like this person if they're a good person. We can only like this novelist if they're a good person in all that they do. And I don't think it always works that way.
Yeah, people are complicated, and life is complicated. People are three-dimensional people and not the cardboard cutouts that we would like for them to be sometimes.
Absolutely.
But those three-dimensional people make great characters in novels. When you're dealing with a character like Ruth Lake and Greg Carver, but Ruth especially. She's such a complex character. How do you continue to challenge her and to give her things that keep her in trouble, but keep us as the reader rooting for her? She's such a complex character, but we're just behind her solidly. What are some of the tricks to keeping a character interesting and keeping the reader in love with them?
Well, I'm really flattered that you say that. I'm really pleased that you feel that way about her. I do love her as well. What happened, I suppose, in the process of thinking about this book too, is that I started thinking, well, why is Ruth so closed? Why is it that she hides her feelings in such a controlled way that she won't reveal the slightest weakness to anyone? What is this about? And it was thinking about that that made me bring in, I suppose, an element of her past. For example, why is it that she changed from being a very successful CSI, and she actually became a crime scene manager, so she was promoted in her job. Why on earth did she change from that to being a police investigator, to being a detective? What makes a person make that huge change in their life? And, you know, what is it in her past that she feels she has to hide from people, even those people that she trusts and works with? So those were elements that I was thinking about as I was planning this novel. And I won't kind of reveal too much, but just to say that someone comes into Ruth's life who she hasn't seen for a good 7 or 8 years, but was very, very central to her life at that time. And it kind of throws her off, so that even Ruth's cool exterior is ruffled by the presence of this new person who's come back into her life.
Well, the new book is The Cutting Room. It's out, available everywhere now. If you fell in love with these characters in book one like I did, you will love this book even more, because the story ramps up, the characters get more complex, and I just love what you guys are doing so much. There's for you two to be so nice and so sweet, you really do torture me, and thank you for that. It's from page one until that huge twist at the end. I'm a big fan, so thank you guys for doing what you do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Is there going to be a book three? Are you guys talking about that yet?
Well, we've got something in development. And this one, I must admit, came to me in a rather strange hallucination, I suppose you might call it, of my own, because I was driving down a motorway near my home in Liverpool, and I saw something which I thought was a person running down the hill at the side of the motorway, and I thought, they're going to get killed. And it wasn't. It was actually something, a piece of clothing that was caught on a branch in the trees. And that gave me the impetus for the third in the Carver and Lake series. So in this story, Ruth Lake sees something at the side of the motorway. She thinks it's someone running down the hill towards the bank towards her. When she investigates, she finds an effigy of a person. And then a week later, a youth is found dead at the side of the motorway. And as Ruth and Greg Carver dig deeper, they discover a spike in the number of deaths by misadventure and suicide on a small problem social housing project nearby, and they uncover a series of vigilante killings.
Okay, I'm in. Take my money. Oh, man. The new book, The Cutting Room, is out, available everywhere now in hardback and audiobook and ebook edition. However you consume books, it's available there. There's links to it in the show notes for this episode. The Cutting Room by Ashley Dyer. Margaret and Helen, thank you guys so much for coming back on the show. And thank you for putting so much care in your books.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. Really appreciate it, Hank.
Tell everybody real quick where they can find your website to dig into more about you guys and to learn more about the series.
Okay, it's at www.ashley-dyer.com.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to see you and to pick up their copy of The Cutting Room. Margaret and Helen, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Author Stories. Go to hankgarner.com to find all of the archives of the show, and be sure to subscribe while you're there. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dreamcoat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
She'd practically caught him with porn.
"You want to hold her? She won't break. Here."
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? "The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her."
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
"I sense..."
She blew smoke and studied its whorls.
"Dissatisfaction in love? Yes? I have just the thing."
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
"This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you."
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.